Well, it is great to be here at Tech, and I want to thank all of you for coming, for the opportunity to have a dialogue, and I'm really happy because my wife, Ann, just walked in, and she's sitting right here in the front row. And she's sitting with a number of great friends, including your delegate, Chris Hurst, and also Delegate Danica Rome, Anthony Flaccavento, running for Congress, and Mary Biggs, who's a great friend on the Montgomery County Board of Supervisors. Thank you. It is very good to be here at Tech. I've had some great happiness in my life connected to Virginia Tech. I was lieutenant governor when then-Governor Warner worked to get Virginia Tech into the ACC, and that was he'll have to write the novel about it someday. But I also had the worst day of my life connected to Virginia Tech, which was the shooting on April 16th, 2007, when I returned within 24 hours from a trade mission abroad to interact with a community in pain, but also to be inspired by a community that was pulling together to deal with the very significant challenge of that day. I'm in touch with Tech families that were affected that day still, helping kids who were wounded get summer jobs, trying to continue to dialogue with the parents who lost loved ones. And it was so painful, but it drew me closer to the community when I saw the tremendous energy and love and community spirit in this place. I'm running for the Senate because I believe in a Virginia that works for all. I've been a term in the Senate, and I have strong committees, armed services, foreign relations, budget, health, education, labor, pension. But what I really do is I listen to Virginians. And I either try to solve problems or I try to take solutions that they give me and then do them. Solving problems. We learned after the shooting at Virginia Tech that holes in the background record check system lead to crimes. And that if you have a better background record check system, you're safer. And so I was able to work as governor to close at the state level gaps in the background check system, and I'm trying to do the same thing at the federal level. I also take solutions from Virginians. There was a day when I was governor that I was given a speech in Roanoke about tourism at the state level, and then President Charlie Steger and the head of Carilion, Ed Murphy, said, "We want to talk to you about an idea." And they came and presented to me the idea of a Virginia Tech Medical School and research complex to be built right in downtown Roanoke. And they asked if I would support it at the state level. And I went to the legislature, Democratic and Republican, and we put in the funding, and that is now a pillar of the Roanoke economy, helping produce cures, helping save lives, and creating economic opportunity in the Roanoke Valley. So that's what I do. My campaign is about a Virginia that works for all. First, listening to Virginians. Second, work. I grew up in the house of an iron worker, working with my dad's iron working and welding shop. I was an economic developer as a mayor in Richmond, as a governor in Virginia. Every year I was governor, Forbes ranked Virginia the best state to do business in the United States, even in the worst recession since the 1930s. And in the Senate now, as a member of the Health, Education, Labor, Pension committees, we push strategies to promote career and technical education, early childhood education, all kinds of strategies to help people get the skills they need and make the investments we need to be economically successful. And finally, and then I want to take your questions, it's about a Virginia that works for all. For all. The last two words in the Pledge of Allegiance. I'm obsessed with those words because I worry that we're, frankly, living in a time where there's too much rhetoric, even from the very top, that isn't about for all. That's about for some. It's about for few. Sometimes it's just about me. But we ask our kids every day to stand in classrooms and look at an American flag and pledge to a nation that isn't just about liberty and justice, but it's about liberty and justice for all. And I believe in jobs for all, and education for all, and health care for all, and equality for all, and security for all. And I think that's what's on the ballot, not only in Virginia, but nationally this November. Are we going to send the message that as Virginians and Americans, that we still embrace the for all value at the end of the Pledge of Allegiance? I'd be honored to have your support and continue in the work, and I look forward to your questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Senator. Our first question from the audience is, recently a stop work order has been issued for the Mountain Valley Pipeline. Many people in Southwest Virginia Many people in Southwest Virginia are concerned with the environmental impact of this pipeline and the effect it will have on our homes and our livelihoods. What is your stance on the Mountain Valley Pipeline?
Let me talk about both the Mountain Valley and the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, because these are two projects that are proceeding in Virginia, and there's a lot of common issues with both. Three things that I'm doing. First, there is a process to determine, A, when is a pipeline needed to meet energy demand, and B, where the pipeline should go. And that's a process that is run by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Because of many complaints from people in this room and others, I became convinced that that FERC process is just outdated and wrong. There hasn't been sufficient procedures to really understand public input in making these decisions. The way FERC determines whether a pipeline is needed is insufficient, and how they listen to public input to determine if it's needed, where should it go, is insufficient too. So I've introduced a bill about a year ago in Congress, bipartisan, introduced a bill in both houses to try to dramatically change the FERC permitting process to give dramatically more public input to it. That's the first thing that we need to do. Second thing we need to do, when FERC granted the permits for both pipelines, they were highly unusual. FERC has five members. There were two vacancies. They voted to grant the permits by a 2-to-1 vote with two vacancies. About a month later, both vacancies were filled. Basically, they rushed to have the vote before they had a full five-member commission. And with the filling of the vacancies, it was possible that had they waited, the vote would have been 3-2 the other direction. In fact, the fact that there was a dissent at all was highly unusual. About 98% of FERC orders are unanimous. So the fact of a dissent was significant, and I weighed in and encouraged FERC to do a rehearing on both of the petitions now that they had a full five-member panel. Finally, the current FERC chairman, who's a President Trump appointee, after listening to people, at least agreed somewhat, we need to redo the FERC permitting process. And they're now doing what's called a public notice and comment about should the process be redone, and if so, how. Senator Warner and I have weighed in, largely using the bill I introduced, to point out a number of ways that the process should be made better. There's also court actions. There's also State Water Control Board has jurisdiction over it. But at the federal level, the FERC process is bad, and it needs to be fixed so that people who live in the route or nearby and their input will be respected.
Thank you so much, Senator. How do you plan to tackle the issue of gun violence and gun control?
Well, I started off and talked about this painful issue, and I had experience at an earlier level, too, because when I got elected to the Richmond City Council, we had the second highest homicide rate in the United States in 1994. When I left office locally in 2001, we had reduced homicide and violent crime by about 60%. When I became governor, we had an effort to try to make Virginia safer. And even with horrible tragedies, like the tragedy at Virginia Tech, by the end of my time as governor, we had worked our way into the ranks of one of the 10 safest states in the country, which Virginia hadn't been in for a very long time, if ever, in terms of our crime stats. What do we need to do about gun violence? There's no single answer. At Virginia Tech, the panel that I put in place to study what went wrong and what should be improved made suggestions about communication and campus safety, made suggestions about mental health that we followed some, but we still need to do more. But part of the answer is also about guns. It's not all about guns, but for those who say it's not anything about guns, bluntly, I just think that's wrong. We had to do tough strategies on guns to bring the crime rate down in Richmond, and we had to fix the background check system in Virginia in the aftermath of Virginia Tech. What should we now do at the federal level? The one thing we should do that would have the most impact is to have universal background checks before the sale or transfer of a gun. There has long been a bipartisan consensus in federal law that there are 9 categories of people that should not have weapons. The most common are convicted felons, those who've been adjudicated mentally ill and dangerous, and people who are subject to domestic violence protective orders. Those are the big 3 categories. And that's been a bipartisan consensus. Those laws have been on the books for decades. But the only way that you can make that prohibition real and keep weapons out of the hands of those whose society has adjudged shouldn't have them, Sung-Wee Cho had been adjudicated mentally ill and dangerous, but the background record check system didn't work. And so the only way that you can keep weapons out of the hands of the dangerous is to have a complete background record check. We came within about 3 votes of getting that passed in April of 2013 in the Senate in the aftermath of the horrible tragedy at Sandy Hook. We've got more work to do. I think we're within a very few votes in the House of getting that one over the hump. But that's the first thing we should do. The second thing I strongly believe is that it is right and completely consistent with the Second Amendment, which I support, to have reasonable regulations, for example, limitations on the size of magazines. Sadly, in these shootings, it's often in the changing out of a magazine that the shooting is stopped. When a magazine is being changed out, the police are able to stop a shooter. In Parkland, the student who was murdering and injuring others tried to change a magazine, and the gun jammed, and that's what stopped the carnage. We accept in Virginia limitations on magazines. We have for years. If you go hunt an animal with a shotgun, you can't have more than 3 rounds in your chamber and magazine. Why? And every state has rules like that. Why? Because it wouldn't be fair to a defenseless animal to hunt an animal with an unlimited or massive magazine. If we understand that when it comes to hunting a defenseless animal, we should have the same rule when it comes to weapons that are designed to produce carnage against people.
Thank you so much. In the last 3 weeks, the EPA has begun formal proceedings for dismantling Obama-era regulations limiting greenhouse gas emissions from both vehicles and power plants. What can and should Congress do to preserve the progress we have made over the past decade in combating climate change?
This is a very important one. And look, Virginia Tech is a center of science, engineering, new energy research. So this is a campus that's right at the heart of this debate. Our climate is changing. Humans are causing a significant portion of it. And if we're responsible and if we care about our kids and grandkids, we'll do something about it. So the two regulations that you reference are first the Clean Power Plan, which allows each state to tailor their own sets of strategies for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. President Trump wants to roll that back, repeal the Obama-era regulation. And the second one is the increase in CAFE standards for vehicles. The American auto manufacturers agreed early in the Obama administration to increase the MPG innovation in the vehicles they produce. And guess what? Not only did they do it, but they started to sell a lot more vehicles. It is absolutely foolish to go back on these two sets of regulations. Absolutely foolish. So what should Congress do about it? The good news is we've got an ability to do something about it. These are both regulations. If the Trump administration changes them, they will change them by regulation. There's a law called the Congressional Review Act that gives Congress the ability to put any regulation up and have an up or down vote about whether it should be accepted or whether it should be rolled back. So if the Trump administration finalizes, they put out an intent to roll back these two regulations, but if they take final action and roll them back, I will co-sponsor CRA's Congressional Review Act statute to try to force a congressional vote on both. I think we need the higher MPG standards in vehicles. The thing is, other nations are doing it. When President Trump says we're going to roll back, what, he doesn't think the American auto industry can be as innovative as other nations? Of course we can be. We just proved we can be. But if we roll back the requirement that it happen, all we will do is let other nations race ahead of us. When the president pulled out of the Paris Climate Accord, it's not like he's stopping the move toward a new energy future. All he's doing is ceding American leadership in the new energy future. We should be leaders of innovation, and nobody would know that better than the talented scientists and engineers here at Virginia Tech.
Thank you so much. As a land-grant university, many of our faculty members work closely with the USDA National Institute for Food and Agriculture. There are plans to move NIFA out of Washington. Do you have a stance on this move, and what do you think? Who do you think would benefit from it? Excuse me.
You know, I mean, I'll be blunt. No, I didn't know that that was being discussed. I generally think, though, if we can take key federal agencies and move them around the country, that's not a bad thing. We have a joint NATO command. It's not in Washington. It's in Norfolk. It's one of two joint NATO commands in the world. The Centers for Disease Control, not in Washington. They're in Atlanta. And so if something that's focused on food safety and agriculture could be better located in a community that is, you know, right in the heart of ag and food production, I mean, that would make sense. Now, I want to compete so that it's in Virginia. You know, we are able to get things like the NATO Joint Command and other key commands in Virginia because we've got a great trained workforce. Ag and forestry is still number one in Virginia. Land-grant university, Virginia Tech, has been connected to ag, to our extension service, from the very first days. But the notion that it might work somewhere else, that doesn't trouble me at all.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. So this next question from the audience. I'm Catholic, and I know that you are also Catholic. What would you say to Catholics like me who support the pro-life movement to vote for you?
Well, first, I would say to anybody, if you're pro-life, advocate for that. Persuade, act, preach, believe, talk to your friends about it. I think that's what being pro-life means, is adopting a moral position and then advocating for it. I am a Catholic, and I live in accord with the rules of my church. But I don't think my job as an elected official is to mandate the rules of the Catholic Church for everybody. I don't think that's the goal. I think abortion is like a number of issues that are really important, where we listen to each other, persuade one another, learn from each other, consult with our own religious beliefs, and then make decisions. There are many issues like that. I'm a Catholic. The number one principle of being Catholic is believing in the divinity of Jesus Christ. But you would never pass a law. You would never pass a law forcing people to do that. We have a society, and actually not a society, I'll say this is a Virginia value, because it was Jefferson who wrote the Statute of Religious Freedom that became the basis of the First Amendment in the Constitution. And the core of the Statute of Religious Freedom is, in our country, people should be able to worship as they please or not without being preferred or punished as a result. And they should be able to pursue their own view of morality and religion. And so I think in the area of, for the questioner or for anybody, these are really important issues. But I think they're issues that are important in the moral realm to persuade and teach about. But prior to the Roe versus Wade case, it wasn't about persuasion and teaching. The Roe versus Wade case was about, can the state use the criminal law, to arrest and prosecute and jail women who make their own reproductive health care decisions? And I don't think that that's what the criminal law is for, and I don't think we should criminalize women's freedom to make their own reproductive health care decisions.
Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. What is your stance on air traffic control privatization, and how would you protect general aviation in Virginia and in the U.S. as a whole?
So this is a big issue that I will say, I've got to say, I'm not the expert on this, but I've certainly been hearing a lot about it. There is a proposal that has been floated for the last few years to do, if not a complete privatization, to establish maybe a nonprofit public-private corporation to take over air traffic control from the FAA. And some nations do that. And there's a lot of debate about it. There are those who significantly think this is a change we should make, using the example of other nations. And then there's two real significant objections to it. One is a set of objections that says, look, this is fundamentally about a way to hurt the FAA workers, including the rights that they have to collectively bargain and bargain for salaries. And second is general aviation. So general aviation, the private pilots, really do not like the idea of the privatization, because they believe, and I'm not a pilot, so this is just what they tell me, they think if there was a privatization, it would really focus almost exclusively on commercial aviation, and it wouldn't sort of take into account or weigh the tremendous general aviation of the country. So I have yet to be convinced, I guess if we're going to talk about a fundamental change, convince me that what we have is broken, and then we'll talk about fundamental change. I've yet to be convinced that what we have is so fundamentally broken that we need to move to a privatization model.
Thank you so much. The political divide in our country seems almost impossible to overcome. Can we fix what has been broken, and how do we start?
I don't think it's as bad as it seems. And I'll tell you what I mean by that. First, with you. Is there division? Sure there's division. But when I'm out around Virginia, in my interaction with people, it's not fundamentally about division. I've been an elected office for 24 years now. The number of face-to-face interactions that I've had with people that were unpleasant, less than 10. Now, anonymous online stuff is a little bit different, but in terms of just interacting with people, people who never have or will vote for me treat me civilly. I think maybe in Virginia it's a little bit, you know, we are a little different. We don't register by party, so we're all technically independents, even if we have a strong lean, and that's a good thing. But I see a great deal of civility and common ground among y'all, among the voters, among people. And there's big divisions on issues, absolutely, but I see a lot of common ground. The one thing I would suggest to you, then I'll get to us, is you can help us, the electeds, be better. If every time you interact with a delegate, senator, congressmember, you ask this question, tell me something really important you're working with someone on the other side of the aisle about. I don't think elected officials hear that enough. And if they heard it from voters, I hear it from mine, but I have colleagues I don't think hear that much. If they heard it all the time from voters, tell me something you're working on with somebody on the other side. I think that would be a good discipline for us. Now, how about us? In the Senate, I'm here to tell you that we cooperate a lot more than you think, but not near enough. Not near enough on the big issues, healthcare costs. Not near enough on letting Congress declare war rather than let presidents of either parties just start wars without Congress, right? But in the just using as an example, in the last 3 weeks, I've had 5 different bills signed by President Trump. I wrote 3 bills dealing with career and technical education that were rolled up into the rewrite of the Perkins Act, and that bill got on President Trump's desk, one dealing with career and tech at middle school, one dealing with attracting talented career and tech teachers, one dealing with governor's career and technical academies like what I did when I was governor. Democratic and Republican co-sponsors put into a bill, passed near unanimously. President Trump signed it. 2 Mondays ago, President Trump signed the Defense Authorizing Act up at Fort Drum, New York. I'm on the Armed Services Committee. I worked on that bill. 2 bills in there were about bringing down the unemployment rate of military spouses. I wrote and introduced those bills with Republicans. They got passed, and President Trump signed them. This stuff happens every day, but you're not likely to read much about it in the newspaper, and I'll tell you why. Cooperation isn't sexy. Division is, and conflict is, and fighting is. That's going to get news. But when you're working together and shaking hands and hammering out a deal and something is passing, that's not going to get attention. So we need to do more, especially on the big issues. And you can help us do more if you challenge us every time. What are you doing with somebody on the other side of the aisle? But every day there are things going on among legislators, even on completely different sides of the aisle, very different on the political spectrum, getting things done. And that's the way I try to approach the job every day.
Thank you so much. Thank you. This will be our last question from the audience for the senator. How do we get students and young people involved in this election?
Well, first, I got to tell you why it's important. You won't get involved if you don't think it's important. So let's start there. And I guess I'll have 2 messages and maybe a practical how-to. First, why it's important. My wife, Ann, and I have 3 kids in their 20s, so slightly older than most tech students, but not too much older. And from my understanding of them and their friends, this generation cares deeply about equality issues. There are fundamental differences between candidates and parties about equality issues. I think for all, and the Pledge of Allegiance means for all. And I think we have to embrace equality for everybody, no matter, you know, where you're from or the accent you have or the color of your skin or your gender or your sexual identity, who you love, your religion, whether you have money, whether you have a degree or you don't, what region you live in. We got to be about equality. And I think young people get that so much, and that's at stake in elections. I think young people are worried about the climate. I think young people are worried about whether they're going to have a planet that they'll inherit that will have the same natural beauty and opportunities that we have. And if you care about it, elections are about that. I think I know young people care about costs of education. Young people care about debt and college costs. Young people wonder why it is in this country you can use the bankruptcy laws to refinance or get rid of a debt on a yacht, on a private plane, on a casino, on an office building, but you can't use those same laws to renegotiate student loan debt. That makes no sense. So the first reason for students or everybody to get involved is there's a whole lot of issues. Healthcare, retirement, the security of our nation and our military. There's a whole lot of issues where these elections make a difference. But the second issue is, it's not just that there's a difference between the candidates. To young people, you make a difference. You make a difference. If you knew that there was a difference between the candidates, but you thought, well, but I'm too, you know, what's the young vote? It's not big enough. I can't make a difference. That's one thing. In Virginia, most races are close. We've had two statewide races in the last 10 years. Statewide races, 2 million votes plus cast, that have been decided by less than 500 votes. We had a race last year that the control of the General Assembly House of Delegates turned on it that came up as a tie. It had to be resolved by a coin flip. Votes make a difference. And so young voters, when they turn out in significant numbers, or anybody if you turn out in significant numbers, the election, you can claim it. You'll be the decision maker. You'll be the difference maker. So the things I would say is, first, on the issues there's a difference, and two, you make a difference. And then the way to get involved is get involved locally. Every one of you, I mean, this is a blessing and a curse. There's an election every year in Virginia. Oh, my gosh. You know, in most states, it's just in the even years, and then you get a break. But in Virginia, state elections in odd years, federal elections in even years, so there's going to be one every year. There will be a race close to you. Might be school board. Might be Blacksburg mayor or town council. Might be the House of Delegates or Senate next year. This year, it's Congress and the Senate. There's a race that's real close to you. So get involved with your party, Democrat or Republican, or get involved with the candidate that you like the most. And you will find it tremendously fun. You'll meet really cool people that you'll love. It will inspire you. And you know what? The other reason to do it is you got to be running for the U.S. Senate one day. Somebody in this room. We've got to have young, first-time, exciting candidates. We've got to have a farm team of young people who are shouldering the mantle of leadership. I ran my first race when I was 35, and I was young then. Now I meet 35-year-olds who are running. I'm like, I feel so old. We got to have 25 and 30 and 35-year-olds to run. And if you start to get involved, some of you will decide, I hope all of you will decide, that public service one way or the other, PTA member, helping a local charity, public service one way or the other is for you. But some of you will decide it's not just public service generally, it's running for office. And the best way to start that is now.